speaking with the chef, owner of the Little Owl, Joey Campanaro. Welcome to Stir the Pots.
Thank you.
Can you describe your food and tell us a little bit something about the restaurant?
It's a Mediterranean American. It's a very small restaurant, corner of Bedford and Grove. The address is 90 Bedford Street. It's been open for 8 months. And basically that's about it. People dig it. People like the food. They like the service. And we like making people happy.
And since you opened the restaurant, you've attained 2 stars in the New York Times. How does that make you feel, first of all?
It feels great. Huh. It's the third time that I've been reviewed in New York City. And it's my second 2-star review. So it feels really good.
And does that mean that a lot of people in France, you know, say it's always best to go to a 2-star restaurant because those are the guys who are working hard to get that 3rd star. Are you going for that?
Never heard of that expression.
Yeah, it's
never heard that.
Pretty well known.
Yeah, never heard of it.
Does having that 2-star make it more difficult for you to maintain what you started with in terms of quality?
No.
No challenge?
Not at all.
Okay.
Not at all. We didn't start off trying to produce food that is categorized by stars. It was just a pure intention to do what we do best, and it's a very small menu. And the guys that I've been working with, we've been working together for over 5 years. So it was really the ambitious part of opening this restaurant and putting this kind of food on the menu is the limitations of the physical plan. It's tiny. The kitchen is 7 by 10, and we have 4 people in there working during any service. So it's dangerous, and if you don't know how to dance with the guy dancing next to you, then somebody's going to get burned. People won't be happy.
So there's a good flow, and you...
It needs to be a good flow. It's not a kitchen where somebody can come in and say, I'd like to do a stage here. This is where you're gonna be. So it's the kind of place where your first day, you're thrown to the sharks. No one there to hold your hand.
Is that part of the planning as, you know, you're determining the space and time to take to prepare food?
It definitely determines our capabilities as far as committing to an item that's on the menu. Minimal pan pickups. I do braised meat. The grill's 2 feet long. There's 6 burners, a deep fryer, and a salamander. And the rest comes from an electric griddle.
And where do you get your ideas from? Is it market-driven or...?
Mostly from the season. Mm-hmm. From the season and... I think a lot of great chefs that have people that work for them that want to excel. A lot of great chefs have people that are influenced by them. If that makes sense, am I making any sense?
Sure.
You learn how to do something when somebody's telling you how to do it, and they're paying you to do it that way. So now it's your chance to say, okay, what's going to be on the menu? I think while you're producing something for somebody, you have your own idea of how you want to do it and how you think it'll, you know, possibly be better or suit what statement you want to get across with what the dish is. And I'd say a lot of ideas come from that. The season mostly. The sous chefs that run specials. And one sous chef is the creative side and the other sous chef is the workhorse. And the one with the most finesse usually wants to write the menu. So they have great ideas, and it's an opportunity for them to grow. The menu and the ideas for the menu come from a lot of different places.
And you're the anchor as the owner and the chef.
That's correct. Uh-huh.
And you have an open kitchen. Does that give you a better view of what's happening in the front? Because there's always been that, the front of the house, back of the house mentality with chefs.
That's exactly what we didn't want here. We don't want that separation between front of the house and back of the house. It's a team. We all work together, and the ultimate goal is a pleasurable experience for our guests. And that's what we need to do is to open it up. I mean, I think having our guests be able to see what we do in the kitchen and have the mystery is taken out of it. But there's also, hey, listen, we're not hiding anything. Look how much room we have. You better be happy that that chicken tastes as good as it does. Or, yeah, you know, we made those buns that little meatball is on. We made them in that little kitchen for you. You don't like it? Get the fuck out.
And what is that famous slider? What does slider mean, or where does that term come from?
It comes from a hamburger. Okay. A little mini hamburgers.
Kind of like a White Castle, but on a better scale.
Right.
Okay. Right. And what's your background in cooking? Where did you start?
I grew up in Philadelphia. Huh. And I worked in professional kitchens in Philadelphia for about 2 years. Then I moved to New York City. And I worked here for another 3 to 5 years. And then I left left New York City and moved to Los Angeles. I was there for 5 years. And now I'm back in the city for 6.
And of those 3 cities, which do you find more interesting for cooking?
Most inspiring, Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
From the
produce
market.
Yeah.
The market, yeah. And the lifestyle.
It reminded me more of a European lifestyle.
Huh, okay. I'd been to Los Angeles before, too. My brother lived there for a long time. And I didn't like it because you had to drive everywhere. And he always said the way you meet people in California is if you hit them on the highway. But the market was fantastic. We went to the Meccan market. And
on Olivera Street.
Yeah, it was pretty damn amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's a market. There's outdoor markets in Santa Monica and in Hollywood, actually, where one's on Wednesday and one's on a Sunday.
Right.
And really big markets.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. There's so many French guys living there and French restaurants and just a lot of different people.
Mm-hmm.
So
Italian, Spanish.
Yeah, so you really get a
whole... Same trends that are going on in New York are going on there. So.
And what trends do you see that are happening in New York that brought you back here?
The trends didn't bring me back.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to open a restaurant in New York all my life.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to be the opening executive chef of a restaurant. And I basically wanted that to be the next step in my career, from being a chef de cuisine, sous chef, chef de cuisine, executive chef, eventually to own a restaurant. And it started out washing dishes, so I didn't think that skipping any steps would really matter. If I started doing it when I was 12 years old, why should I skip a step now and let natural progression take its place? Like Macbeth talks about free will and destiny, you make it happen or you let it happen. And in my career path in the restaurant business, I felt that it was a wiser decision to let it happen. So eventually someone approached me and asked me if I would be the executive chef of the restaurant, and I thought that would be, you know, it to my benefit, where I'm not looking for it. I'm not forcing this to happen. This is coming to me. This is something that I've always wanted. So I thought, I'm going to go with it. And it's led me here.
And how hard is it to start a restaurant in New York City now? I mean, financially, it's got to be pretty high hill.
It depends on what kind of ideas you have, if they're far-fetched or... I mean, with this restaurant, we didn't have any crazy ideas. We wanted to bring it down to bare bones. And it was this beautiful tin ceiling that was covered with ceiling fans and track lighting. And I mean, if making something look as beautiful as it did when it was originally built is a trend, then that's the trend. But I don't know. Can that be considered a trend? I doubt it.
And are you scared that in some way you'll fall into a fad where people go, oh, got to go to this place because, oh, everybody's going there? Or are you going, great, that's more business for me?
I think it's impossible to happen. Well, there's only 5 tables that get reserved a night.
Huh.
I don't think everybody has that opportunity. What I'd like to happen is that same interest remains and people are patient to actually experience something that, you know, is what we think we do best, which is receiving guests, offering them a table for as long as they like, as long as it takes to have dinner, and a truly hospitable experience with quality food and interesting wines and pretty waitresses.
Yes. That's always a plus.
Mm-hmm.
And do you consider ever opening anything else besides this place itself? Or
I'd like to open a market, a produce market, solar-powered produce market in the city, in Manhattan.
And are those dreams coming to fruition?
Who knows?
Yeah.
I can't. Can't say. I don't really have that much time to devote to looking for the place. I mean, it's going to be hard to find.
And
I don't want to put solar panels up. I don't want to incur that expense in the business as working capital. What I'd like to do is find a place that has solar power and be able to let that place be in a neighborhood that has the demand for it, and then supply that demand.
And you think, like, Manhattan is still the most important borough for cooking, or you think the other boroughs are going to open up eventually to blossom other restaurants, kind of like yours?
I don't think so. I think the standard's going to be set in Manhattan. New York City is gastronomic capital of the United States, and San Francisco. So I would think so. And those things, I mean, those, that interest in becoming a chef, and I mean, that's where it started. Alice Waters, the entrance of the French chefs that were racking up all the 4 stars, all the 4-star reviews, and then the aspiration for American chefs to first and foremost to get a job in these places. That was a feat in itself. I don't think that's important right now. I think that boom is over. I think the people, the American chefs that did have that opportunity and took advantage of that opportunity and learned and worked their asses off and got every part of an experience that they could out of it, I think that they're instilling that same vision in their kitchens now. So if you want to come through the ranks with me, that's how I run the business. You walk in the door, you start as a dishwasher. Eventually, you get down to the prep kitchen. Is that promotion? You know what? Yeah. Now you're prepping vegetables, you're not washing dishes. What do you want to do? You want to wash dishes? Then you can't work here. If you want to work here, you have to want to cook. You have to want your own business. You have to want to excel. There is an air of competition because sometimes, you know, there are 2 dishwashers. Well, who's going to get the job? The one who says, what's next, chef? First, that's what's going to happen, and that's the race. I feel that's been my work ethic since I began, and it's taken me to where I want to be as a business owner and an executive chef.
And how do you see your restaurant? Is it a neighborhood restaurant, or is it a destination restaurant?
It's definitely a neighborhood restaurant, and you know, with press and with TV shows and Food Network. Those are all great, but still, we have 10 tables. So who are we reaching out to? And we question, are we earning these reviews because of our egos? Or what was our mission? To say, let's go unemployed for a year, let's ask people for a bunch of money, and tell them we're going to give them a bunch of money back. Let's take on 40 new children as parents, as managers, as business owners. I mean children in a good way, not in a bad way, but more so, and you're responsible for them in a way. So you choose who you want to work for. You know, our gravy is going to be the neighborhood. So that's why we don't reserve all the 10 tables that we have. There's hope and there's longevity in a business where, in a restaurant business, where somebody can walk in off the street. Not everyone plans their dinner a month in advance. And for a restaurant to completely book itself in one of the greatest neighborhoods in Manhattan, if not the greatest neighborhood. And really all you're doing is cutting off your nose to spite your face.
And do you have like signature dishes that are going to just be part of the menu all the time?
You know, the neighborhood really dictates that. When they come in, or people with reservations, they come in and they say, and they come in the second time and they say, well, I want to try other things on the menu, but I love this so much, I'm going to have this. This is what I came here for. Well, if that's what you came here for, then that's how it becomes a signature dish. In planning stages of a menu, there's no signature dish that, okay, this is my salmon dish, this is my chicken dish, this is my signature dish. That doesn't happen in menu development. That happens, the guests make that call. They decide what the signature dish is, not the chef.
So in keeping those signature dishes, or do you change them, or do you ever take them away?
The wise thing is, you do things that are available and at their best year-round. For instance, we have a dish that everyone comes in the summertime, they have it, in the wintertime, they have it. It's because it's the pork chop. You can have the pork chop in the summertime. It comes with butter beans, which are dried beans. In order to make them taste like anything, you have to know how to cook them. And fennel, which is pickled, sauce that's made with fennel and garlic, the dandelion greens, which are available year-round. You can have them in their small stage, you can have them while they're a little bit bigger. Once they begin to wilt, that same process is happening. The bitterness is being counteracted from the acidity. So it's not really, wow, that asparagus is so fresh right now. Now, okay, that's our signature dish when asparagus is in season. Yeah, maybe the soft-shell crab is our signature dish in the summertime. But year-round, well, I'll keep the pork chop on the menu. It's been a menu item of mine in three different restaurants that I've worked in the city for the last 6 years. There's no reason to take it off.
Yeah, because I had read some reviews, and you know, it mentioned how you had the sliders, the pork, and I said, well, you know, I wonder if you get, like, shackled down to having to do those things, or can you really just move on?
I'm not shackled down. Yeah. I want to do them. Like, for instance, if it was a wild striped bass, and that was our signature dish, I'm going to be breaking a lot of hearts, because when striped bass, and I'm selling the signature dish for $22, because that's how much it costs to put on, you know, it makes sense to run it at that cost. Well, when that fish is $8 a pound, is your signature dish now $32? Your signature dish is a go-to dish, the way I see it. And if somebody wants to have it, and it's their staple, and it's their, I go there. I mean, restaurants pride themselves and set their business tone on consistency. And people come back for what they had. If that's gone, and we call ourselves a seasonal American Mediterranean restaurant. Well, what's seasonal about it? Well, it's American Mediterranean. Seasonal stuff, you come in the summertime, we'll have soft shell crabs. Come in the wintertime, we won't have soft shell crabs. You can have a pork chop.
Cool. And how about wine? I mean, I saw that in a review also, they were talking about how your wine is really good prices and there's a real range. How do you determine to have the food and the wine speak to each other? Is there a... Who's the wine guy here?
My business partner, Gabriel Stolman.
Okay.
Gabriel, G-A-B-R-I-E-L. Stulman.
Okay.
And his wine list is, I think, successful not only because of his determination in providing a well-balanced selection from varietal, from region to women winemakers. There's a section on his list called Vintage Vines, which is six or seven bottles of wine that come from vines that are 100 years old or older. Some of the wine list is broken down into varietals. So somebody can look on the list and find the word Chardonnay because they like Chardonnay, and it'll be there for them. Someone sees a region in Austria that they're familiar with, they can have that. If someone's familiar with a woman winemaker, it's an easily navigated list. And it's a list that's for the guest. It's not for the person who made the list.
So it's user-friendly.
Exactly.
Okay. And how did you
and
come
in such a small place, it's interactive, because sometimes our guests sit up there, and then we can't get to the wine, so we make them get it for us.
That's good. They're a partnership in the business.
What usually happens is they end up buying what they actually have to get. It's like, oh, this is the wine. Oh, I want to try this one. Hopefully it's a $350 bottle of wine, but sometimes it isn't. Sometimes it's a $38 bottle.
Get up there a little further up.
No. Keep going.
It's funny because I used to live in this neighborhood, and being a chef myself, I used to walk by this place before it became your restaurant, And I used to go, wow, this place is closed down. How did you come about finding it?
My wife found it and told me to call the number. And I was like, baby, there's no number on the window. It's just closed. So every day, we come by in the morning, and we pass it every day. And one day it was up, and I called. And submitted a letter of intent, our business plan, professional financial references, and our concept was chosen out of actually 150 candidates, which is what we were told.
And from that inception, how long did it take to open up?
5 months, 4.5 months.
So it was pretty much ready to go, but it needed some spiffing up. And
well, no, it was. We did a lot of work. Uh-huh. Yeah, we completely demoed the entire space and rebuilt it.
Uh-huh. And you did that
so
all yourself?
So it was about 2.5 months of, well, with the general contractor.
Oh, okay.
I broke down some walls myself, but I didn't really build. I rebuilt the oven, the stoves, took it apart. Changed some pieces, put it back together, made it work. And it's great. It's like an army tank. It's a garland from the 60s, you know. It's, I think that thing, no governors, just go.
Cool.
It's about 5 months from signing the lease. It was about 2.5 months of waiting for permits and 2.5 months of construction. Finish work.
And how quick was the response for people coming in as soon as you opened the doors? Or?
Our first night we did over 60 couples.
Wow.
And that's been the standard.
So the neighborhood's pretty hungry, I guess, for a good restaurant.
I guess. I mean, I think there are a lot of good restaurants in West Village. I don't think it's just that. I think there's more of an experience that's brought to it. It's a unique experience from the service, from the greeting at the door, from shaking hands with the owner, from looking at the chef in the kitchen to be able to see what exactly what's going on. It's a different experience. And it's not so much a sound experience. It's really worked out. I don't know if it's because of the speakers or what, but or the placement of them. But when you sit in this room, you can sit across from someone, understand what they're saying, and then have this buzz that's an energy, has a bump.
Yeah, I find that a lot of times I go to restaurants where the food's really great, but I can't hear what the other person's saying, and I just can't enjoy the meal because it's so loud. The acoustics are really
terrible. It really takes away from the experience.
Yeah. And is it really necessary to have that much music blasting out? Yeah.
No, some people like the music, some people don't like the music. Somebody says, can you turn the music down? Sure. Can you turn the music down? Somebody says, can you turn the music up? Say, sure. Turn the music up. And when somebody says, I told you to turn the music down, I say, well, that person told us to turn it up. So we give you what you want. Do you want to talk about it?
How
we'll switch songs. You have a request? Oh, yeah, it was because I don't like Stevie Wonder. I like Frank Sinatra. Fine. How about if you both listen to Tony Bennett? Sure. So we run our music system on iTunes and an iPod, and we can give them whatever they want instantly.
Right. And how hard is it to get a reservation now?
We take reservations month to the date. So in that month when things happen, like what we do is we collect names and add them to a wait list. And first person on the wait list will get a call at the first cancellation of a reservation. And then so forth and so on down the line.
And what are you going to be doing for Valentine's Day?
We have a special menu for Valentine's Day. It's $80 per person. It's a four-course tasting menu with options in each course and a romantic experience.
Right. Let's see if I can get a reservation then. I'm going to have to come and try everything.
Good luck.
Okay. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks.